My dear brothers and sisters, by strange coincidence, Sister Angela reminded me this morning that we hadn't thanked you for inviting it. So I'll do that now, if I may, and also make an apology. I'm afraid we came with probably several million unwanted guests in our throats and noses. And I hope you were able to hear me, but it's very difficult. I have a soft voice at the best of times, but it's been affected, you know, by this dreadful cold. So if you can't hear me, would you just indicate and I'll try and up the volume? Well, with that over, we now look at David's greatest failure, sadly. But before we begin this study, I have to stress that in considering David's sin, it's inevitable that one can seem to be judgmental. And that's not intentional. By now, you'll know I have a very great esteem for David. He, for me, is one of the loveliest characters in the Old Testament. And I've repeatedly made the point that if he's a man after God's own heart, then he was very special. But he wasn't perfect. And we're going to consider one of the rather dreadful episodes in his life. But just to remind us that God's assessment is fairly clear. David did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, turning not aside from anything he commanded him all the days of his life. You know, that's like an achievement, isn't it? And then that dreadful ending, except save only in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And I think it's significant, we'll come back to this, but I think it's significant that it doesn't say the matter of Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. All right, it was adultery and it was murder, but it seems almost as though God has concentrated on the murder rather than combining it with the adultery. Now, of course, we also need to bear in mind something for which we can be grateful. As Paul wrote to Timothy, faithful is a saying and worthy of all acceptation, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, such as we are. And then he said, and I suppose we could almost echo this ourselves, of whom I am chief. But we can take comfort, brothers and sisters, that although David failed, he was forgiven, as God through Christ Jesus has forgiven us, as Paul says in Ephesians 4. Well, the scene is set. After a successful rout of the Syrians, the former allies of Ammon, it only remained for the army to be sent under Job's command to, as it were, mop up the remainder. During the fighting season, when kings go forth to battle, as the record has it, he was sent to destroy the Ammonite stronghold of Rabbah, which means the great city. It's modern Amman, of course, the capital of Jordan. And so the record says, this is what happened. And the last phrase, the last sentence, but David tarried at Jerusalem. And the reason isn't specified. We don't know why he didn't go with his army, just to, as it were, clear up the situation. Often in the past, of course, kings let their generals do all the hard work and then went in the sort of last final mop-up to claim glory. But why David stayed, we just don't know. Mind, he was no longer a young man, probably in his 50s, probably his late 50s. He'd still be fairly active, but he wasn't the young man he used to be. And later in the record, in 2 Samuel 21, there's an incident where David almost lost his life. And as a consequence, his men thought it was too risky for him to go out to battle in future. And I wonder whether in this case there was something very similar, that there'd been some incident, and the men said, look, you know, you're our king, we need to protect you, and so don't come with us in this particular campaign. Of course, David had got very close to being killed. Ish-Benob, one of the sons of the giant, a relative of Goliath, of course, 300 shekels of brass was his spear. He had a new sword and thought to have slain David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succoured him and smote the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore unto him, saying, Thou shalt go no more out with us to battle, that thou quench not the lamp of Israel. So perhaps we have here an explanation as to why David was not in charge of his army at this particular point. It's also possible, of course, he was recovering from illness. I mean, this did happen occasionally, of course. He was not exempt from that. And so after his afternoon siesta, it seems that David walked on the roof of the palace. It came to pass at eventide that David arose from off his bed, walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. One artist suggests it was something like this. He was on the parapet, looked out, and across the way he could just see in the distance a woman bathing. And so David sent and inquired as to who she was. And one said, Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now, I'm the sort of person who always is curious about why we're told some things and not told other things. And for me, this incident raises several questions. Why was she visible from the roof of the palace? Why was she taking a bath on the rooftop where perhaps anyone in a taller building could see her? Why did David not know that this was the location of the house of one of his top generals, Uriah? Again, that's odd in my mind. I mean, Uriah was one of his most valiant soldiers. He presumably knew which house was his. I hope you won't think this indelicate, but if she was in her altogether, how did the servant identify her, if you see what I mean? At a distance, she'd probably, if it's a fair distance, it wouldn't be easy to identify her. I mean, I wonder whether the servant was called to the rooftop and says, who's that woman over there? Or perhaps by now she'd gone down into the house and he had to ask, the roof over there, whose house is it? Well, she was very beautiful, says the record, and in her unclothed state, she unknowingly conquered David's self-restraint. The man who'd fought lions and bears and giants, the man who'd gained victories over absolutely overwhelming odds, was helpless at the sight of Bathsheba. He had no shield against her beauty. And I imagine very few men in such circumstances would have readily turned away. As king, imbued with power and authority, he was used to having his own way. And David was at that moment in danger of becoming a king like all the nations round about. Now, if I might digress just for a moment, the late Brother Dennis Gillett made an interesting comment. He observed that we all have at least one significant weakness. I know someone very well for whom that weakness is chocolate. In my own case, it's books. But I think he was meaning more in weakness of character rather than those things. And there is circumstantial evidence that, to put it bluntly, David was in many ways a womanizer. Consider the following. He had seven wives when he came from Hebron, before he ruled in Jerusalem. Michael, Ahinoam, Abigail, Maacah, Haggith, Abital, Eglah. And of course they had sons. And it didn't stop there. David took in more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem when he was come from Hebron and was yet sons and daughters born to him. And when, there's the Absalom's rebellion, it says the king left 10 women, which were concubines, to keep the house. Presumably the others went with him. And there must have been quite an entourage of womenfolk, his wives and concubines, leaving, and he left 10 to keep the house in order, assuming that he would return, and I'm sure he felt that God would bring him back. Job says when Absalom was killed, that he'd shame the faces of all his servants, the lives of his sons and daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines. So David was now an eastern potentate. He had wives who were, as were technically, the mothers of his successors, and concubines, well, I suppose it was legal prostitution, for want of a better word. And later on, when Nathan rebuked David, he said, "I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom." In other words, Saul's family and wives. "And if it had been too little, I'd have added unto thee such and such things." So it really, you know, why then Bathsheba? With such a harem, as it probably were called in the Middle East later on. Why Bathsheba? And just finally, this is an insight, I think, of his servants. "Now King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him in clothes, but he gat no heat. Therefore his servant said unto him, 'Let me sought for my lord the king a young virgin, and let her stand before the king and cherish him, and let her lie in thy bosom, that my lord the king may get heat.'" I suppose it's a human hot water bottle, isn't it, really? But you see, I think their idea was, one of the reasons perhaps he was feeling cold, perhaps his heart wasn't pumping all that well, and this young woman would, of course, affect him in that way. So they knew what David was like. And it's sad to think that this, you know, was his great weakness. Well, once the servant had informed David of the identity of this woman on the rooftop who'd been bathing, that she was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, the matter should have ended there, shouldn't it? She was married, and she was married to one of his loyal servants. Yet David sent messengers to the house and took her. Some have suggested there's complicity on her part, and say that really she had some responsibility for what happened subsequently. And I think there are some matters that we ought to consider here. I may have got them in the wrong order of importance, but first of all, how easy was it a woman in those days to refuse the king's invitation or even a command? Commentators say the kings of the surrounding nations had the prerogative of taking any man's wife if they fancied. Well, again, that was not God's way. Of course, the invitation might have been couched in innocent terms. "Would you like to come to dinner at the palace and have dinner with me and some of my wives?" It might have sounded quite innocent. But I think the most likely reason is that she would worry that if anything happened to Uriah, she would be a widow. And the Talmud apparently says a warrior gave his wife a divorce before going into battle. But I don't think that was necessarily enforced quite so early. But you know, it's worth asking, after all these battles, how many wives became widows? And I can't help wondering whether Bathsheba was really concerned here, and maybe it was part of her intention, having received the invitation, to seduce the king and perhaps secure her future if anything happened to Uriah. Now, the record tells us something which is very important. David sent messengers and took her, and she came into him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, and then she returned unto our house. In that situation, did they think that the risk of pregnancy was quite low? It possibly could have been. Or is it a reference to the subsequent action where she would be required to perform ablutions according to Leviticus 15? Whatever the reason, it certainly indicates that she could not have been pregnant by Uriah when David took her, and that's important. She could not have been expecting Uriah's baby. Modern translations make that quite clear. So, time passed. A month or two, perhaps, before her condition became evident to her. The message is sent to David: "I am with child." Now, the discretion of David's servants is one thing. The birth of an unexpected baby is quite another. With Uriah away on a lengthy campaign, there'd be a lot of explaining to do. Bathsheba had conceived a child. David conceived a plan to solve the problem. And so we come now to 2 Samuel 11. And immediately a messenger, verse 6, was taken, sent urgently to Joab. The message was simple: send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab responded, and Uriah was duly dispatched homewards. You can imagine the conversation that might have been something like this. What does the king want? I don't know. He didn't say. And on the journey, you can imagine, as Uriah went homeward to the palace, he'd be weighing up the possibilities. Am I going to be promoted? Or am I going to be demoted? Why wasn't the purpose of my being summoned to the king disclosed? Why wasn't it mentioned? Perhaps I'm going to receive some secret orders and therefore Joab couldn't be told about it. Then when he's interviewed by the king, I think something was given away there, because it was a very shallow interview. David asks about Joab, how the people fared, how the war prospered. Perhaps it might not have been what was the weather like, but it was that level. You know, something that really, in a sense, was almost irrelevant. And in any case, Uriah could say, well, why did the king send for me, you know, a general, to give him this information? He could have got this from a junior minion. Just anybody in the ranks could have gone and told David, you know, how things were going. Uriah was one of the 30 mighty men, not a messenger boy. And I think his suspicions would begin to be aroused now. Fine, oh, that's good to know, says David. Go home and refresh yourself. I mean, it was tempting to do this. After all, it was the king's command. And he'd probably not had much creature comforts for some time. And the king sent a present, perhaps some delicacy from the royal kitchen, so that Uriah and Bathsheba could enjoy an intimate supper and maybe solve his problem. Uriah was nothing if not cautious. He might have felt as uncomfortable as he confessed to David the next day. You see, he and David had known hard times, but good times. They'd fought in battles for the Lord. Even now, he said, Joab and his fellow officers and his men were camped in the open field. They were denied the comforts of a home. How could he go home and put his feet up when that was going on? So Uriah slept at the palace that night, along with the other servants of David. Perhaps he talked with them. It's just possible someone let something slip. Or equally suspicious, no one talked to him much, as though they were terrified of giving something away. Well, next day, David asked whether Uriah had gone home, and learning that he hadn't, would summon him to explain himself. Why didn't you go home as I commanded you? How could he? You see, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in booths, in tents. And my lord Joab and the servants my lord are encamped in the open field. Shall I then go into my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing. You see, what Uriah could have legitimately done, supported by the king's command, he refused. While David, who had no right whatsoever to do this, had done it eagerly. Well, David hadn't given up yet. Stay today also, and tomorrow you may depart. Well, Uriah spent another boring day in the palace. Once more he would talk to David's staff, and if nothing had been let slip the night before, maybe on this occasion something would be said. That night, David dined and presumably wined him. Eventually, the excessive amount of wine perhaps began to take some effect. And in this mildly inebriated state, David was sure that his resolve would now be weakened and he would go home to his wife. But no, he would not. David was now in desperate straits. He couldn't force Uriah to go into Bathsheba. And even if that had occurred, the timing of a possible, and not certain, possible subsequent child would always seem a little premature. But it might just have worked, I imagine David thought. Now the charade couldn't continue. A far more radical solution was required. David wrote sealed orders to Joab. And how ironical, Uriah carried back to battle his own death warrant. The idea was simple enough. Joab was to give Uriah a tough job to do, the sort of thing he revelled in. And then when he was in distress, don't go to his aid, leave him to his fate. And he will no doubt be killed. This isn't the David we know and love, is it? There was that time, you'll probably remember, when David longed nostalgically to have some of the water from the well in Bethlehem. And it's recorded retrospectively in 2 Samuel 23. We're told that three of his valiant warriors broke through the Philistine lines to collect some water for David. And they brought it to him. You know, what do you think about it? They loved him so much that for a drink of water to please him, they would risk their lives. And David appreciated this. He wouldn't drink it. No, he poured it out to the Lord, as the record says. The three mighty men broke through and drew the water and brought it to David, but he would not drink thereof, but poured it out unto the Lord, as if to say, this is your blood, or it could have been, couldn't it? I won't drink of it, we'll pour it out to the Lord in symbol. And he said, be it far from me, O Lord, and assured this, that I should drink the blood of men that went in jeopardy of their lives. Therefore he would not drink it. These things did these three mighty men. You know, it just gives us a clue, doesn't it, of how he could inspire men. And now he would readily and literally pour out Uriah's blood on the ground. Well, Job did it, he was commanded. You wonder whether his motivation was such that, Uriah might have challenged him for leadership in the future, get rid of a possible opponent. And Uriah was placed in this impossible position. He was abandoned at the crucial moment, and along with the other men with him, met his death. You see, not just Uriah, but those with him. I wonder whether Uriah felt he'd nothing to lose now. And so he was even more courageous, risking his life completely and then losing it. When Job instructed the messenger to go and inform David, the scripture account reads like a series of coded messages. He anticipates even the wording with which the king would draw an analogy with an incident recorded in Judges 9, where you remember a woman in the city of Thebes killed Abimelech by hurling a millstone on him as he came near the wall. And perhaps that was one of the most dangerous positions in a battle, because your enemy was above and they were in the superior position, weren't they? So the message came, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. I mean, what sort of explanation of what seemed like a tactical blunder was that? But the point is, it would confirm to David that the orders regarding Uriah had been carried out. All this, no doubt, was rehearsed in the hearing of David's courtiers. David's reply was not only for Joab, but of course for public consumption as well. You know, these things happen. War is a nasty business. So David said to the messenger, thus thou shalt thou say to Joab, let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city and overthrow it, and encourage thou him. Yeah, platitudes in a way, isn't it? But now David felt safe. Bathsheba would still be anxious because her husband was now dead. She was a widow and carrying a child by another. And she couldn't know at that point whether he would disown her or not. She mourned for Uriah, her remorse no doubt heightened by her sense of betrayal of her husband. Now the period of mourning was probably 7 days. And then with the formalities over, David did the, in quotes, honourable thing, humanly speaking, and brought Bathsheba into the palace to be his wife. I imagine a lot of people, totally unaware of the true situation, thought this was a generous act on David's part. His expression of his appreciation of what this valiant servant Uriah had done in the past. We can only surmise what people thought, but one thing we're certain of. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord. See, the law of God had been broken twice, adultery and murder, and the Levitical code and its repetition in Deuteronomy made it quite plain there was only one penalty for these crimes, and that was death. So, we now have a problem. Going on into 2 Samuel 12, the Lord sent Nathan to David. We don't know how long the interval was, but the Lord now is going to, as it were, have it out with David. It's likely that Nathan was a relatively young man because he was there at the end of David's life. And it's interesting, you see, Nathan doesn't actually accuse David directly, but he appears to be presenting with a legal case for determination. And for David, it might seem just like any day when he was sitting in judgment on his throne. And Nathan made the point that he came to him and said, we've got a problem here. There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. And the rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he had brought up and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and his children, and it did eat of his own morsel and drank of his own cup. I think that's a bit of an unhygienic situation, but there we are. He's making the point, it was treasured by this man. And it lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. And then there came a traveller unto the rich man, and he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. Well, David was furious. His deep sense of justice and the depravity of this case caused him to exclaim, "This is a capital offence. This man must die." Well, of course, it wasn't. It was theft. And if you stole a lamb or a sheep, you had to restore fourfold. But David was so incensed that someone who was rich and prosperous, and had got plenty of lambs that he could use to feed his guests, went and took the only lamb of another neighbour who'd next to nothing. He was outraged, wasn't he? And the record says, David's anger was kindled greatly, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord liveth, this man that has done this is worthy to die." And David set a trap for himself. There's someone, Nathan there seems a lot older than I think he probably was, but there we are. "This man deserves to die," was David's judgment. "Thou art the man." That must have come as a terrible blow to David. He'd judged himself. And by this means of a parable, Nathan had been able to bring David to his senses. If he'd just gone to the king and accused him, David might have denied it and there'd be a quarrel. I remember the late Brother Harry Whittaker once saying that if you've got a problem in the ecclesia, don't just raise it as a problem. Start with a question. Is it right that we're doing this, or should we be doing that? And once you do that, it takes something of the possible confrontation out of it. People have to think about it. Whereas you just stand up at a business meeting and say, "We shouldn't be doing this," you'll always find some opposition. Well, Nathan, no doubt guided by God, had done the right thing, getting David, as it were, to judge himself. It was self-condemnation. In that moment, David learned something that the writer to the Hebrews makes, the point he makes. "The word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing of soul and spirit and to the joints and marrow, and quick," or living, "to discern the thoughts and intents of the heart." Now Nathan continues to say to David the message that God has sent him to deliver. God anointed him king over Israel, he said, and God delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom. I gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added unto thee such and such things. God's beneficence to David was extensive, but if it had been insufficient, God would have made it up. He would have added more. And though we tend to focus on David's adultery and the murder of Uriah, there was another commandment which David broke, and if he kept it, there wouldn't have been a problem. In Exodus chapter 20, thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife. And if David had remembered that and kept it, there wouldn't have been a problem, would there? And now Nathan asks a penetrating question. Wherefore hast thou despised the word of the Lord to do that was evil in his sight? Thou hast smitten Uriah the Hittite with the sword and taken his wife to be thy wife, and hast slain with the sword of the children of Ammon. You see, what emerges here is the link between intent and action. Without knowledge of what David intended, everyone would conclude that Uriah died at the hands of the Ammonites in battle. But in reality, David contrived his death, and so was a murderer. And you see, it's very interesting. The Romans were responsible for the Lord's crucifixion, weren't they? But the Jews were the ones who were culpable. And that's why I think when the Lord said, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do," he was referring to the Romans. But the Jews knew exactly what they were doing because they'd plotted his death for some time, hadn't they? And so in Acts, Peter says that he was delivered up by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, and by the hands of lawless men, he was crucified and slain. And again, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom ye slew, hanging him on a tree. And he's addressing the Jews, not the Romans. And the Lord Jesus has a teaching which I think is very, very appropriate here. I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now, fortunately, looketh here in the Greek is continuous. It isn't one glance. I think most men, if they met a beautiful woman, would notice it. But what the Lord says here is someone who is, as it were, reveling this and is lusting with the hope of perhaps eventually committing adultery. And the Lord says, in a sense, he's already done it in his heart. And of course, the Lord said something very similar about hatred, didn't he? He said it was really tantamount to murder. Often, the only reason someone didn't murder someone he hated was he didn't have the opportunity. And I suppose there's a parallel here. And so now David learns what would befall him and his house. And the murder is dealt with before the adultery. So the results of David's sin would be that the sword would not depart of his own house. It would claim more victims, but this time it was to be among the members of David's household. And so David took Uriah's wife in secret and in darkness. His own wives would be taken by another publicly, that is, before all Israel and before the sun. We shall see how that worked out later. And so Nathan's prophecy is quite detailed and specific. The sword will never depart, and because you've despised me. You see, that's the point. It wasn't just an offence against Uriah. He despised God. And taking the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. And so God said, I'll raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. How sad. Not an enemy outside, but within his own household. And then he says, I'll take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them unto thy neighbour, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I'll do this thing before Israel and before the sun. Of course, we know that was eventually fulfilled in the case of Absalom. We learn this as history unfolds. I mean, four of David's sons are attributable to David's murder of Uriah. There's the unnamed child of Bathsheba. There's Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah. And other deaths were probably indirectly attributable, including the 18 who, according to one version of the Greek Old Testament, perished with Uriah. So it wasn't just Uriah on his own. The men that were with him, 18 of them, died as well. And Absalom would be the one close to him, which during his rebellion, you remember, as a sign of his assumed kingship in replacing David, he took David's concubines and had a tent erected on the palace roof, the very place where David's sin began, and went into them. And just as David had appropriated Saul's wife, this was quite common when rulers took over from each other, this would be taken by another, Absalom. David's response is quite interesting. I have sinned against the Lord. He doesn't mention the ill that he's done to Bathsheba and Uriah. I have sinned against the Lord. He'd murdered Uriah, he'd seduced Bathsheba, but his sin was against the Lord. And in a sense, he was under a death sentence, wasn't he, from that very moment. Nathan says to David, the Lord also put away thy sin, and thou shalt not die. You know, that would be the normal consequence of his sins, both capital offences. See, there was no remedy under the law. You couldn't pay a fine or offer tremendous sacrifices. It was death, and it was your death. Only the Lord could put away his sin. For in this case, there was no more sacrifice for sins, for what David had done, but a certain fearful looking off for judgment, as Hebrews says. And again, you see, the law was quite clear. The man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. There's never mention, as far as I know, that Bathsheba was told that she would be, as it were, executed for her sin. And again, you know, murder, whoso killeth any person, the murderer, or the manslayer, shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses, but one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. Well, Job could be a witness, and of course the Lord himself would be the other, and therefore their testimony could not be gainsaid. David was spared judgment on himself, but the sin could not be condoned. And I find it very sad, brothers and sisters, that this child of this illicit union would die. The baby became critically ill. You know, Bathsheba must have really suffered. I mean, this was, I suppose, her punishment. As far as we know, she and Uriah had no children, so this would be her first baby. It suffered, but not knowingly. At that age, perhaps, well, it wouldn't have, I mean, it was suffering, but it wouldn't have a conscious sense of suffering. The real suffering was experienced by David and Bathsheba. At last, David was his old self. He besought God for the life of the child, fasting and laying all night on the ground. There was nothing presumptuous in this. He knew his God. He was to say on a later occasion to Gad, I'm in a great strait. Let us fall now into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great. And let me not fall into the hand of man. And it was just possible that his sin had been forgiven and the child might survive. The child had done no wrong. David knew that. And he had faith that God would do that which is right. Now, there may be an ethical problem for us here. And sometimes we don't understand God's ways, but we can always be sure that he is a just God and exercises justice, and God's conclusion in this matter must be right. David's servants didn't think the child warranted this kind of behaviour, because they probably didn't know what was going on. But David had a deeper awareness. Psalm 51 is lovely, isn't it? Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever with me. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done that which is evil in thy sight. There was no sacrifice possible. And so, for thou delightest not in sacrifice, else I would give it. Thou hast no pleasure in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. And this was David's condition, wasn't it? Lying on the ground, not eating, just waiting and praying that God would save the child. 7 days passed with no improvement. Then it died. How could David's servants break the news to him? If he was so distressed when the child was ill, eating nothing for 7 days, how would he react when he knew it had died? Well, David somehow sensed what was going on. Maybe they were whispering, what should we tell him? And so on. And so he arose from the ground at this point and fully accepted the Lord's answer. While the child was alive, there was hope. Now the answer was final. And David recognized that life for the living must go on. But you see, Nathan's prophecy had claimed its first victim. Of course, the servants were puzzled. What is this thing that thou hast done? Thou didst weep and fast for the child while it was alive, but when the child was dead, thou didst rise and eat bread. And David was quite logical. While the child was yet alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knoweth whether the Lord will be gracious to me, and the child may live. But now he is dead, wherefore should I fast? Can I bring him back again? And then a very profound statement. I shall go to him, one day I'll die, but he shall not return to me. It's interesting, isn't it? The child died nameless. He should have been circumcised and named on the 8th day, but he died on the 7th. It was almost as though he had not been, to take a phrase from the book of Job. This is what Job said. If he died in the womb, he'd have been as though he'd not been. I should be carried from the womb to the grave. And sadly, this was the fate, really, wasn't it? Virtually the fate of this child. No doubt Bathsheba would be as distressed as David, especially, as I said before, this may well have been her first child. And so David comforted Bathsheba, his wife, and went into her. And she conceived. And this child was named Solomon, beloved of God. That's lovely, isn't it? Solomon, but not that wrong. It's Jedidiah, the bottom line there, which means beloved of God. That's lovely, isn't it? Well, brothers and sisters, we've come through this difficult time in David's life, a real low point. But there's some wonderful lessons, aren't there, for us to ponder and to recognise that even though David made great mistakes, he recovered from them. And because he was a man after God's heart most of the time, in many ways God forgave him. And although there were going to be problems, you can't stop the sin's effects. At least David's life was saved. And we shall continue, God willing, after coffee with part 4, David as a sovereign.